Evidence-based medicine dictates the treatments that you get for the conditions you have. But where did it come from? How did it get here? Where did it all begin? That's the topic of this Straight Talk on Health. Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Chet Zelasko. Welcome to another edition of Straight Talk on Health. Before we begin, just a couple of things. Straight Talk on Health and the information contained within is for informational and educational purposes only. Don't use it to treat or diagnose any diseases. What my goal by doing Straight Talk on Health is to help you have a discussion about what you hear that I say or what you may have seen in the press and have a discussion with your healthcare professional. They are the ones that are in charge of your health with you. Because as I always say, health is a choice, and you need to choose wisely. But that also means that you should have frank discussions with your physician about what you hear, about what you read, and about what you see. And that includes what we cover here on Straight Talk on Health. The second thing is that Straight Talk on Health is copywritten. Please don't share it with anyone else. As an insider or a member, it is your right to listen to it. If you have something you want someone to absolutely hear, sure, play it for them on your smartphone. But other than that, you pay for it, and let's keep it between you and I. Now let's get into our topic, evidence-based medicine. I get a lot of emails. I get a lot of emails from scientific journals. Most of the time, what they're doing is announcing what's in the next edition. Now, with the Journal of the American Medical Association, what's interesting is that they have so many different journals now. The one that I typically would get would be related to cardiovascular disease. But anymore, they have ones on oncology. They have some on pediatrics. You pick a slice of what you can find in medicine, and the Journal of the American Medical Association has a journal to cover it. And that's okay because there's a lot of research that's being published each and every month. But this one was a little different. This one announced the video series, and it immediately attracted my attention. And the title was Evidence-Based Medicine, How It Began. One of the things that you might have heard about probably 10 years ago now, when they first passed the Affordable Care Act, that there were going to be death panels. Well, there never was any such thing. But what they were going to try and do was to have discussions about treatment before procedures were actually done. They were going to try and get together a group of people who were experts in the field based on the scientific evidence to decide what treatment is best. Now, at the time, there was a physician who actually was here in the state of Michigan who really opposed that because if you looked at his record, he did more hip replacements and knee replacements on people over 80 than anyone else in the state of Michigan at that time. Of course, he would object to that because there are other options for people over 80. And one of the things that you have to consider is what their pain level is, not just discomfort, but actual pain, whether it affects their mobility, and on and on and on. That's evidence-based medicine. Of course, someone who's a surgeon isn't going to want anyone else to tell them what they should or should not do, and they certainly don't want insurance companies to base payment on that. I understand that completely. Nevertheless, that's the way evidence-based medicine was supposed to be used, and to some degree, is being used today. You might have heard of the United States Task Force for Preventive Services. Now, this is a large group of physicians, and it changes by expertise level, who get together, look at all of the research, and I really do mean all of it, and decide what are the best tests to do, and therefore then what are the recommendations for treatment. The last time that they caught a lot of attention was when they decided to switch from doing mammograms starting at the age of 40 every 2 years to mammograms over the age of 50 every 2 years. That created a firestorm. Your physician has the right to overrule that recommendation. But especially with the tentative healthcare programs that we have today, we don't know whether it's going to be covered completely or not, as it might have been in the past. That created a real firestorm, including my personal physician, who had three women, including two relatives, one a sister, who would never have been diagnosed early enough to prevent the spread of breast cancer. They would have been diagnosed too late by the time it got to be a lump that they would have noticed. True, that's just one family and their experience with it, but I think it's significant. So what my purpose on this Straight Talk on Health is just to give you a background on how evidence-based medicine was supposed to be used, especially how it began, and what were the criteria for the reasons why it was begun at all. And so this video, and you can watch it, by the way, if you go to JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, and I think it's JAMA.org, and you type in video and evidence-based medicine in their search bar, you don't have to be a member. Now, you may have to join as like a follower or something like that, but the videos, these videos are open to everyone, and it's really informative. I don't think it's very dry, and it certainly will give you perspective of how your healthcare is determined. This was a panel of people who began evidence-based medicine. The moderator was David Sackett. It included Ian Chalmers, Moore Gray, Kay Dickerson, Paul Glasziou, Brian Hayes, Drummond Rene, and Gordon Guyette. Now, these were all physicians. Evidence-based medicine began around 1992, and they started with this one basic tenet. Our goal is to determine the best course of action in healing the patient. And that came up with a follow-up question. How do you decide what's best? There are values and preferences of healthcare staff and patients. Whose do you use? Well, the panel concluded that it should be the patient's values and preferences. Here's the thing that sort of sets the stage. Before evidence-based medicine began, the way a physician would treat you for any condition that you had was based on their experience. It would be based on where they got their education, where they did their residency, in other words, which hospital, where they did anything if they had a specialty, if they were going to be a surgeon, if they were going to be an oncologist, if they're going to be a cardiovascular diagnostician, would be based on what they learned during their basic training and during their advanced training. If they went to a different school or if they were trained at a different hospital under the direction of different experts, their treatment choices might have been different. There are some people who, by their training, would take one course of action. Let's say if you were diagnosed with some form of cancer, there would be another group who would be trained differently and might do a different course of action. That's, call it training-based medicine, for lack of a better term. What this group of scientists wanted to do was to be able to look at all of the available research, sort of exclude the training of the individual from it. That's important. You certainly want a skilled surgeon if you're going to have some kind of surgery done, but there has to be a way, based on all the clinical trials that were ever done on treatments, to come up with a plan that can stand the test of evidence. And that's really what their criteria was. I also like the statement that they have in here that I read earlier was, who should decide what's best for the patient? Should it be the physician, or based on their values and preferences, or should it be based on the patient and their values and preferences? And so what evidence-based medicine tells you is, it tells you what to do based on what the evidence is. but it doesn't tell you what to do in the context of the values and preferences of the patients that tells you how to do it. The point is, it should be shared decision-making with the patient and physician based on the evidence available. Now, that should be relatively simple for a patient with one condition. But what they then go on to say is, today, in today's society, the problem is, how are you going to prioritize people with multiple conditions? What do you treat first? Now, this is where it really gets complicated, because there's not enough evidence-based medicine standards due to the lack of evidence. And in this video, they spend a lot of time talking about this. There's a lot of reasons why evidence is missing. There's not enough clinical research trials. And of the ones that are done, some of them are not done very well. You also have bias. What do I mean by that? Well, there is the bias that comes from the pharmaceutical industry. There are bias from the medical devices industry, because, of course, they want to sell pharmaceuticals and they want to sell medical devices. And so they fund a lot of studies. Doesn't mean that every study that they fund is bad. They have to have certain criteria with which they publish accurate results. But the problem lies in the research that's done that never gets published, because that tells you what doesn't work or what might not work as well as enough to reach statistical significance, for lack of a better term. Now, I talk a lot about statistical significance in a lot of the writings that I do, and I would assume that you get the memos, and I talk about it in a lot of other things that I write. Statistical significance means that there is a difference between a control group and the treatment group. In a lot of cases, you may do some kind of sham, and that means placebo. Where it gets complicated is when you get into medical devices and when you get into surgery at all. Is there any difference between doing the surgery and actually doing the surgery the way it was designed to do it? All right, that sounds a little confusing. They did a study on sham research on scraping out cartilage inside knee joints. In one case, and this is a tough case to get approval from any human subjects committee, they opened the knees up just the same way they would do it if you were doing surgery. And most is done with laparoscope, so we're not talking about huge incisions here. They opened it up, they did what they would normally do, and they closed it down. They did not actually go in and scrape the cartilage, etc., out. Then they did it. They actually did the surgery in another group of subjects. And what they found is that there was no difference in pain between the subjects. Now, that's not going to be able to be done in every kind of surgery. If I got a 100% blockage in one of my coronary arteries, you better believe I want that artery replaced with a bypass graft. No question about it, or at least opened up, if possible, by angioplasty. But short of that, it's very difficult to do. But that's what I was getting at. The problem when research is not published, either because it's statistically not significant or it doesn't give you the outcome that's desired by the person that did the research, is that there's information that's not being able to be used in the decision of how to treat patients. And to some degree, if you have something that you spend a lot of time on and it's not going to get published because it's not statistically significant, or it's going to be more difficult to do it, then it stays in the drawer. And what they tried to do is get the data that was in the drawers to be able to make evidence-based medicine decisions. One another problem that they found is that there's just no evidence of treatment for a lot of different conditions that are out there. Another thing that they cite is that there's a lack of data on safety and harms. How do interventions actually affect patients in their day-to-day lives? Let me give you a specific example. If you have high cholesterol, one of the treatments is going to be a statin medication. I can't tell you the number of people that have written to me and asked, I'm on this statin medication. I've gone through my third one, and I still get this horrible muscle pain. Is there anything else I can do? Well, that becomes problematic. That's where people have a dramatic impact because taking the statin causes muscle pain. Now, that one's fairly common. But there may be other things that happen. For example, if you're taking a beta blocker and you are fatigued all the time, you may not associate taking a beta blocker with that kind of fatigue. It may not be extraordinary fatigue, but you just don't have that old snap. Well, the problem is beta blockers, because they slow down heart rate by affecting the beta receptors and blocking them, that can cause an effect on other beta receptors in the body, and that can lead to a decline in energy. It can actually lead to erectile dysfunction, loss of libido, and other things. Now, those are not always harms that are reported. Because you see, if there's a harm that a medication or a treatment is causing, it gets reported to the FDA database. Now, if people keep what's going on in their lives to themselves, that never gets put into the database. Have you ever watched a commercial? You know, the one where they give you a medication and the wonderful thing it's supposed to do for 15 seconds, and then they spend 45 seconds telling you all the reasons that you shouldn't take it or what it can interfere with and all the harms that can occur. That's the kind of thing that are evidence-based. But there are so many others that can affect the quality day-to-day living that are never reported. What I think that physicians have to do is think about how treatments affect people in their day-to-day life. And I question whether physicians really think about that question very much. Because if you have someone who is alive and vital, and you're treating their type 2 diabetes by coming up with a medication first instead of a lifestyle change first, that can have an impact on their life. For example, metformin, one of the side effects that can happen is it can cause loose stool. Not diarrhea, but certainly it can have an impact on your bowel movements. And my experience is people don't like change in that area of their life. They like things to be nice and regular. Well, that doesn't necessarily happen all the time when you take some medications. Now, if you go and listen to this again, and you'll notice that I talked about statins, I talked about beta blockers, and I talked in this case about metformin. I'm not saying that those things happen to everybody, but they certainly can have an impact on their quality of life. Not enough is known about quality of life types of things when it comes to certain types of treatments. There's a lack of evidence as it relates to that. So where does this leave us today? Well, it leaves us in a place where evidence-based medicine is an excellent idea, and we need more of it done so that we can determine the treatments that we get based on the evidence. But there's another corollary to this that should be a part of it, and I don't think it's there enough. And that's, what does the patient want? Because remember, and especially if you listen to the video, you will find out that their goal was to try and come up with the best treatments, but base it not on what the physician was trained to do, but on what the evidence says, in addition to considering the values and preferences of the patient. Let me tell you this story. My mother-in-law, God rest her soul, in that short period of time before she passed away, probably had some form of cancer, probably colon cancer. To do the type of testing that would be required to diagnose her might have killed her, might have ended her life or sooner. Even if she could survive that test, the type of treatment that would be required at 89, she could never survive. And so the decision was made in conjunction with the feeling of Paula, who was the person in charge of her mother's health. She had the power of attorney, that no diagnostics would be done and no treatments would be done. That was what my mother-in-law desired, because much earlier she had done an intent to treat. It was something that all four of us did, my mother-in-law, father-in-law, Paula, and I, where we went through a huge series of questions and filled out what would we want done if we were not able to make the decisions for ourselves. It was like 12 pages long, but we all filled one out. There were several things that my mother-in-law desired, and that was, if there was no effect on the outcome, which would have been, in this case, death, she did not want anything that would prolong her life. Doing the testing and then the possible treatments would never have prolonged her life. Now, she lived another 3-4 months and died relatively peacefully. But it was her decision originally that had to be decided upon by Paula, as her power of attorney for health care, that was her wishes. Now, it just so happened that coincided with her treating physician's values and preferences as well. But it was a discussion that had to happen. Today, I question whether there's enough discussion that's based on the patient's preferences and values. And I don't mean someone is of a religious belief and they're not going to get any treatment at all. That's not what I mean. It is a matter of discussion whether someone wants to take some form of treatment that may extend their life for 6 months, but will render them horribly incapacitated in some way. It may be cancer, it may be some other condition. Or whether they choose to have no treatment, are kept comfortable, and when it's time to go, they go. That's the kind of thing that evidence-based medicine is really supposed to do, where the options are given to you, and it isn't what the physician wants, it's what the patient wants, based on their values and their preferences. That is where evidence-based medicine is supposed to go. Now, will it completely go in that direction? We'll see. There's a lot of lack of money. That sounds horrible to say it that way. But in today's climate, the National Institutes of Health and other funding companies are being cut. Whether research will continue to be done, other than a drug trial and other than some other types of treatment trials, we don't know. Because of the lack of funding, we may not get to what the best treatments are, or the treatments that we get may be biased by who's doing the funding. Regardless of that, here's the thing that's important, and there's two takeaway messages from this. One, we have to do better, and that's what the panel said. If you're overweight, if you have hypertension, if you're pre-diabetic, there is so much that you can do by changing your lifestyle that can help you maybe avoid treatment whatsoever, and it will certainly improve the quality of your life. What we have to do as a society is get away from relying on pills and putting it in doctors' hands. Your health is in your hands, folks. I mean, that's the critical thing here. And the second part of the equation is actually what I put in the beginning of Straight Talk on Health. And that's that I'm not here to diagnose or treat any disease. What I am here to do is to give you information with which you can talk to your healthcare provider. And that's the responsible thing for you to do. But it's also their responsibility to lay out the options based on the evidence first and based on their training second. I'll give you one more example of this. When Paula had her hip replaced several years ago, the physician that she had, who was one of the top surgeons in the Grand Rapids area, only did the behind sort of hip replacement. Today, the standard of care is doing it from the front. You cut a lot less muscle, the recovery is a lot greater, and it's a lot faster. He absolutely refused to do the front at that time, and that's fine. Paula had the best of care. She recovered well. She's doing fine with that hip. It has given her no problem since then. But now, some 5 years later, he only does exclusively front hip replacements for the very reasons that I said. Now, it isn't that the science has changed that much in 5 years. He was going based on what he knew, even though he was the best, not on what the evidence was pointing to. That's the discussions that we have to have with our physicians. Now, I talk to my physicians, urologist, primary care physician, cardiologist, and what I want is for you to have that same feeling of authority that you have the right to do that too, because you do. And that in whatever treatment you decide, get the best of information based on the evidence. Get the best information based on your physician's experience, because that's important. And then together, you come up with a strategic plan for the treatment of whatever's going on in your life. That's how evidence-based medicine started, and that's where we stand today. Until next time, this is Dr. Chet Salasko, finishing this Straight Talk on Health, as I always do, with one question. What are you prepared to do today?